morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Kristen Espeland has a look back at the biggest environmental stories of 2008. First, many area Ford employees are home this week as the two Louisville plants remain dark. They're temporarily shut down, but the idle workers could affect the local economy in the meantime. Gabe Buller talked to John Talmadge, president of the Washington, D.C.-based retail research group Social Compact, about what the furloughs mean for Louisville's consumer climate.
The situation with the Ford plants in Kentucky, there are two here near Louisville. The Kentucky truck plant is on furlough and shut down. It shut down on the 15th of this month of December and is furloughed until the 2nd of February. And the Louisville assembly plant is it shut down on the 27th of November, and it'll start up again after the 12th of January. So do these types of closings have an effect on nearby businesses?
Well, absolutely they do. What's a little bit unknown right now is what the impact of the bailout may be in terms of whether the wage fund will be open to these workers. But regardless of that, a laid-off worker, even if they are receiving unemployment insurance and continue to receive their fund, is still going to behave more conservatively with their discretionary income, because they're still, even though the plants are expected to reopen, we don't know what condition the plants may reopen at, whether it's with a smaller workforce or the same workforce or the length of it. So I think all in all that the message this has on the local economy is to probably spend more discreetly on basic needs, and I'm sure that's going to have an impact on restaurants, retail, and whatnot. In terms of the larger economies, it's still acting in more conservatively as well.
So in terms of the businesses around the plants, would those see less business if people aren't going to the plants?
Well, if you know, the businesses that are directly adjacent to the plant or in the area, of course, the restaurants, so people where people may have stopped by out on the way to and from work, those will have a direct impact. But I also think that the neighborhoods where the workers reside will also see an impact as well.
And have you looked at any of the businesses near the plants or in Louisville lately?
Well, we're in the process of doing a general analysis of the small business community, because one of the things, after we had baselined the economic conditions last year, we want to continue to follow this work over the next 2 or 3 years so that we can see what the velocity of change may be. Because I think the good news is Mayor Abramson and his economic development team at Metropolitan Development Corporation have done such a good job at trying to diversify the economy. And there's even some of the automobile suppliers have plans to expand their workforce in the Louisville region. So I think the net gain is still a positive for Louisville vis-a-vis the rest of the Midwest. But what we want to do is begin to really make sure we understand what the impact is on the small business community that are so dependent on these workers for their sustenance.
So what will happen if some of these employees are laid off? What will that mean for businesses, and what will it mean for the employees? Where will they go?
Well, I think we typically understand that for every employee in manufacturing, there's a 2 to 3 job spillover impact on what that worker brings to the economy. And we will see, a decline if those workers are laid off, and especially if they're permanent layoffs. We will see a direct decline in retail, restaurant, non-basic goods services that are so dependent on discretionary income. People will still go to grocery stores and they'll still buy the things that they need to buy. But one of the things we are seeing in the economy in general is that while the first wave of subprime foreclosures or option arm resets was attributable to the high cost loans, this next wave we're seeing is really attributable to the economy and unemployment. So it's not just my fear. It's not just the impact this may have on business, but in general the impact this may have on loans and debt and other things that have a much larger spillover effect than simple retail.
You said you were doing a study in Louisville. Did any of that touch on the effect of having the auto workers here?
Well, what we do in our work is we try to find the missed population and missed income, and we look at that in an aggregated basis. It's hard to to hold for a specific industry sector. But I think as we go forward, we will be able to, we're going to start mapping where different category of workers live and what the impact may be on the, that sector itself. But we have not done that to date.
That was Gabe Bullard talking to Social Compact President John Talmadge. We'll be starting 2009 with a new president, new environmental regulations, and one of the most dismal economic outlooks in recent memory. To find out what that will mean for our nation's and our region's natural resources, Kristen Espelon takes stock of what happened in 2008.
This was the year where climate change went from being controversial to being conventional.
Attorney Tom Fitzgerald heads the Kentucky Resources Council. He says the so-called debate about the science behind climate change faded away this year, and leaders are facing up to its realities. For instance, in the state legislature, Fitzgerald says lawmakers put forth several bills aimed at fighting global warming, including one to provide tax credits for energy efficiency projects.
Kentucky actually made some significant strides in the area of energy efficiency, in the area of climate change, and in the area of environmental policy.
But Fitzgerald says the biggest lost opportunity for the environment this year was the lack of any national legislation dealing with climate change. And as the economy worsens, Fitzgerald says he's worried the focus will turn away from environmental issues. He says funding for Kentucky's environmental programs is already tight.
The big constraint and the big concern now on the environmental front are the serial reductions in budget that have been inflicted on the Energy and Environment Cabinet.
Fitzgerald says the cabinet was already laboring under a reduced budget when the most recent financial crisis hit. And tighter funding will mean, for example, that the cabinet won't be able to step up surface mining inspections. When it comes to mining, mountaintop removal remained a big story in 2008 in Kentucky and worldwide. The BBC sent reporters to document the practice this year. Several books have just been published on the topic, and a new controversial rule that loosens regulations for placing mine waste in valley streams drew the public ire of several Appalachian governors, including Kentucky's Steve Beshear. But despite the attention, Kentucky Sierra Club spokeswoman Betsy Bennett says the practice continued to damage water quality in mountain communities.
With every valley fill permit that's been issued for a mountaintop removal site, we've lost more streams in Kentucky.
Recently released Environmental Protection Agency data shows that more than 1,000 miles of streams have already been buried with debris. And Bennett says her group is looking to the incoming presidential administration to address the issue. Journalists will be watching, too. Society for Environmental Journalists spokesman Bud Ward says many reporters believe President-elect Barack Obama will be the president to tackle the biggest environmental issue heading into 2009, global warming.
And I think there's reason to be optimistic at this point that the commitment may be real and not just posturing. Nonetheless, it's going to require extraordinary leadership at all levels.
And Ward says it will require keeping global warming front and center. He says environmental media coverage in 2008 helped to accomplish that, although it evolved to reflect several related crises that hit this year.
I think it started the year as the biggest environmental story. In mid-08, it became kind of part of the energy story.
And now Ward says it's become part of the economic crisis story. Concerns are mounting over whether the economy will trump environmental issues or even cause environmental funding to dry up. What's more, keeping environmental stories in front of readers and listeners may be more difficult in 2009. Ward says that with so many newsroom cuts nationwide, environmental news could fall to the bottom of the news editor's list. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
The destruction of America's chemical weapons is well underway. High-tech incinerators are at work in Utah, Arkansas, Alabama, and Oregon. But progress is slow at the Bluegrass Army Depot in Madison County, Kentucky. All of its chemical weapons remain in place, awaiting the construction of disposal facilities. Nearly a decade ago, Kentucky rejected incineration, saying it was too risky. Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton explains.
As a military facility, access to the Bluegrass Army Depot is restricted. Most folks can only get as close as a chain-link fence which runs parallel to US 25. Don't feel bad, though, I was also denied access. The depot is in central Kentucky, about halfway between the towns of Richmond and Berea. Besides conventional weapons, its stockpile includes an increasingly unstable inventory of chemical weapons. The arsenal includes about 100,000 pounds of mustard gas, nerve agents like sarin and VX, and the rockets which would drop them on an enemy. A dozen years ago, Congress decided, with Kentucky's approval, to build a revolutionary disposal facility. It uses chemicals to neutralize the weapons, but funding cuts and design problems delayed construction both in Kentucky and at a similar site in Colorado. Kevin Flam manages both projects for the U.S. Army.
Both Kentucky and Colorado will be pilot facilities, and they'll be going through the same learning curve that the incineration sites went through when we first started JCADS and Tooele. But again, we have engineering controls in place to ensure that those startup, those baby steps within the operation are done in a very safe, environmentally sound manner.
The Army projects it will take at least 8 more years to destroy all of the depot's chemical weapons. Given their expertise with thoroughbreds, Kentuckians are pretty good at picking a winner. But given the depot's delays, some people believe Kentucky has backed the wrong horse. Actually, the depot's in a couple races. Under an international treaty, those chemical weapons must be destroyed within 4 years. More pressing, as warheads and rockets age, the risk of a serious accident increases. In the average year, 5 more leaking weapons are discovered. The 16,000 residents of Hermiston, Oregon, who live near the Umatilla Army Depot, are in a similar race against time. Their neighborhood includes some of the world's nastiest weapons. Now, though, according to former Hermiston Mayor Frank Harkenreiter, life in Northeast Oregon is a bit safer.
The worst part of this nerve agent that you want to know about has been destroyed. It's all gone.
The last of Oregon's sarin gas was incinerated this fall without incident. Similar incinerators are also at work in Tooele, Utah, and Anniston, Alabama, where over half of their munitions are destroyed. The incinerator at Pine Bluff, Arkansas, is about one-fifth finished with its work, and the very first purpose-built chemical weapons incinerator, which operated on a Pacific island, has completed work and has been demolished. Given such progress, former Berea Mayor Clifford Kirby, who served in the 1980s on a citizens panel which considered the Bluegrass Army Depot's disposal options, believes Kentucky fell behind in its race when it rejected incineration.
We know it works. The system they're looking at now, it may work. We don't know, and it's never been used or proven in bulk destruction of this stuff. So it will be an experiment in our backyard.
In fact, chemical neutralization is a proven technology. It eliminated weapons stored in Newport, Indiana, and Aberdeen, Maryland. But Kirby calls those small operations. He says the cleanup at the Bluegrass Army Depot is a much larger, more complex task.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. If we could go ahead and get started.
A meeting in early December of the Chemical Weapons Working Group considered the depot's problems. The watchdog group strongly opposes incineration. While it seems successful at other sites, Director Craig Williams says there may be health impacts we just don't know about yet.
There's been no body bags that we can account for. There have been 18 documented releases of live agent out the stack that we can document. My guess is there have been dozens, if not hundreds, more.
If anything, Williams argues Kentucky's choice of chemical neutralization accelerated the cleanup. He says the Commonwealth took just 2 years to permit the plant. The average for an incinerator is 7 years. So, Williams says a switch now to incineration would be dangerous and time-consuming.
They'd have to go back and redesign the incinerator because they've learned so many lessons from the 4 that are out there that they would never repeat them. So they'd have to go back and start really from ground zero. And all of that time and design change and all of that stuff, plus all the permitting time and so on and so forth, it would be astronomical and we would never get done. So that's just a ludicrous, you know, position for people to be still saying at this stage of the game.
But if Kentucky had initially backed incineration, Cliff Kirby contends the Army would have accelerated work. Even now, Kirby argues, the Commonwealth can change its bet.
Seeing the results of the other places' incinerators, I would definitely say I would pick incineration and get started building an incinerator.
To Kirby, at least, delays at the Bluegrass Army Depot now make a serious accident there seem inevitable. Mayor Frank Harkenreiter, who's also a fan of incineration, has either lived alongside or worked with Army munitions all of his life. As a teenager, Harkenreiter stacked bombs at the Umatilla Army Depot. When working inside the earth in igloos where weapons are stored, the 82-year-old warns a moment of inattention can kill.
The only accident they ever had when an igloo blew up, and that was back in 1940, 44 or something, an igloo blew up by accident, killed six people. But that was, a fork truck hit a bomb or something.
Unless the U.S. Congress intervenes, it seems likely, though, Kentucky will stay the course and back chemical neutralization. Watchdog groups claim it remains the most popular choice. Meanwhile, the depot's race against time will continue. Kentuckians will watch the work and push for more money, and everyone will hope no one trips up. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer checks in with how fundraising is going at the Metro United Way. You're in Studio 619 on WFDL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll learn more about a new mental health court in Northern Kentucky. First, for its 2007 fundraising campaign, Metro United Way set out to raise more than $30 million, but it missed the mark by $800,000. This year, it has a goal to raise just over $29.2 million. The current campaign is now in its final days. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with United Way President and CEO Joe Tolan about where the campaign is now.
How is the United Way campaign going this year?
Most United Ways of size in the country at this stage do not expect to be able to get to or exceed last year's total. We have an actual shot at that. No guarantee, but we're shooting for $29.2 million and a dollar, or a penny, to exceed last year's total. We're presently at about $27 million, which is about where we expected to be in normal years, so that's good news. And if we can get some additional donors to step up, we think we have a reasonable shot at reaching last year's total and maybe exceeding a tiny bit. And that would be terrific because social services and human services have taken enormous cuts and are really in tough shape.
Where are the donors coming from this year, and do they seem to be coming from different places than they have in past campaigns?
We're seeing a lot of double-digit increases in smaller companies. And we think that when human need is in the news every day, every hour, it makes us more alert to it. And folks more alert to it, their inclination is to try to help out if they can. And so we're seeing a lot of new donors. And that's important because major sectors of the economy locally have seen major cutbacks in workforce, you know, automotive industry and whatnot. And so to kind of make up for that, if other folks don't step up, you go backwards. And so far, it's been holding. We have a sense of things being urgent and terribly, terribly important.
How do your levels now compare to campaigns in the past, not just last year, but previous years?
We've been holding pretty much level for several years. We had a very strong increase a couple of years ago, one of the strongest increases in a major market at the time in the country. And really what we try to do is we try to benchmark ourselves up against similar communities because the economies are not the same community to community. I just came back from visiting relatives in Detroit, and they've been in a really tough recession for years. They have double-digit unemployment and whatnot. And we have a more diverse economy here. We used to be the 10th largest manufacturing center in the country 20 years ago or so. We have a much larger services sector at this point. And, of course, UPS and logistics and all of that has helped out enormously.
At this time, when you come to the holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, and when you come to the end of the year, you find that people give more. And how does this time compare to other years?
We're actually running right about on pace with recent years. And that's a pleasant surprise to us because, you know, we're seeing the difficulties that are out there. There's been a number of folks who wish to give what they were giving, and frankly, they're not in the position to. And so we respect that. We appreciate what they're able to do. They'll be back at a higher level when things turn up for them. But overall, we've had a lot of folks who are new to the effort step up. We have a wonderful challenge grant of $200,000 from an anonymous donor that was given to us just a few weeks ago. And that individual is matching new and increased gifts between now and the end of the year. And we have a good part of that match, but not all of it.
Does the donation have to be of a certain level?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
It can be any level whatsoever. If someone gives $5, that becomes $10.
in conducting the campaign, but also working with your member organizations. How are they coping with the economy right now and the cuts that they've had to endure in public funding from the state and city?
It's been very tough for them. I have been in the realm of social services for a long time, almost 40 years. And I have never seen a time when all funding sources were retrenching to one degree or another. So it's one thing if there's a down United Way campaign one year. It's another thing if there's some down public funding and some down private giving. When it hits all three at the same time, it puts incredible pressure. And in the field of mental health services, for example, in Kentucky, statewide, the current budget reduced funding to mental health services by $40 million. That's an enormous hit. Local communities are not able to make that up. And we will see that literally on the streets of our community because there are folks who are not able to get the services because there's been a cutback in services and there have been layoffs at a number of agencies.
How are the agencies looking to create ways to bridge the lack of resources to meet the needs or maximize what they do have?
Well, they're doing a good job at that. There have been some consolidations of agencies recently. The Family Place and Family and Children's First has agreed, the two boards have agreed to come together. There'll be some economies as a result of that effort, and that will help so that less is going into support services and more is going into the direct services to people. Others have done a good job at prioritizing, which is what you have to do.
And what is Metro United Way and its member organizations hearing from people in need right now?
We're hearing more demand. We're hearing lots from people who have never had to ask for help before. We refer to folks who are a paycheck away from poverty as marginal income families. And the fact is the number of families who are on that edge is higher than it's been in 10 years. That's not just an economic thing. That's a stress factor that can indirectly lead to higher incidence, which in fact it is doing, of domestic violence. The Center for Women and Families is getting more calls than they normally get. And if someone has lost their income as well as other things, then they're under more emotional stress and more fragile and more violence can erupt.
Looking at those downward effects that can really severely impact a community,
okay,
how can a community climb out of that?
The good news is that I think sometimes folks think that if they can't make a gigantic gift, they can't make a difference. And that's absolutely not true. Every single gift, no matter its size, does make a difference. If someone can afford $5, the magic of a United Way campaign is that it's not one person giving $5, it's 5,000 people giving $5. And so we can make a difference. We can also volunteer. Folks can call us, they can call 211, and they can get information on services if there's a need that they or a friend or a loved one has. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's also a number that you can call and say, I'm interested in volunteering. There's 1,000 things that every single one of us can do that can help soften the pressures and the blows that the economy is dealing out these days.
And aside from the volunteer part of it, just trying to reach the goal that you've set for yourself in this campaign in the coming months, what are you going to be doing to try to reach that?
Reaching out to every supporter that we have. And so we've got a couple more months of good hard work, good old-fashioned hard work to do, and convey the message of the need and what a difference a gift can make. It's about making sure that folks have an opportunity to have hope replace despair.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
In November, Northern Kentucky opened its first mental health court, which is just the second of its kind in the state. To find out how the new court operates, Kentucky Public Radio's Steve Hirschberg talked with Dr. Julie Raines, an assistant professor of political science, criminal justice, and public administration at Northern Kentucky University.
A mental health court is a jail diversion program. It's a lot like drug treatment court, for anyone who's familiar with that term. And what happens is if someone is arrested and they suffer from persistent mental illness, and that persistent mental illness is at the root of why they got arrested, it caused their behavior, then what happens is they are diverted to a different judge, and a judge who hears all mental health court cases. And then instead of going to jail, they're put into treatment programs. So they receive counseling treatment, they receive medication, they receive case management to make sure that they go to their appointments and they stay on their medication. If they're eligible for disability, then we help them get their disability benefits. If they are homeless, then we help them to find low-cost housing, that kind of thing. If they have a co-occurring disorder, meaning if they also have a substance abuse problem, then what we do is we'll line up some recovery or some drug treatment for them. And so this saves the criminal justice system a lot of money. And at the same time, it helps people who really are being arrested primarily because they suffer from persistent mental illness more than anything else.
Where in Northern Kentucky is the new mental health court operating?
The new mental health court is regional, so it services Boone, Campbell, and Kenton counties. Because it's more centrally located, the court meets in the Kenton County Courthouse one day a month. Eventually, once the numbers are large enough, once there are enough participants, it might meet twice a month, but it will probably always be located in Kenton County just because that's easier for folks to get to, particularly since it's on a bus line and that kind of thing.
How do people get diverted to the mental health court?
When someone's arrested in Kentucky, and this is true anywhere in the state, and this is true in most states, actually, usually they're seen within 12 hours of arrest by someone from pretrial services, and that's how it works in Kentucky. And so pretrial services will screen them with a short questionnaire that flags potential candidates for the program. It identifies where they may suffer from a persistent mental illness. Of course, the little quiz that they take screens a lot more people into the program than actually, you know, qualify for the program. And so we have to do secondary screenings on folks who are felony convictions. We don't want to release anyone into the community that would be a danger to themselves or others. And so, for example, we don't accept anyone who is a murderer or someone who's committed arson. We don't accept anyone who's a higher level felony. We don't accept anyone who's a sex offender into the program. So we look at some different criteria to make sure that they'll be a good fit for the program. And then we also do some secondary screening on folks who are felony cases to make sure that they won't be dangerous. And then once they go through that process, they're admitted into the mental health court.
For those who qualify, is diversion to the mental health court voluntary?
This program is completely voluntary for the participant. They do not have to participate in this program. They can just take their chances in regular court. There are quite a few who aren't facing any real jail time, so they're not appropriate for the court. There are others who qualify for other diversionary-type programs, so they're not appropriate for the court. There are folks who are so paranoid, schizophrenic, they think that if they join our program that we'll put transistors in their brains, and so they usually are not willing to be a part of this program. So, yes, it's completely voluntary, and even after they are accepted into the program, at any time they can change their minds, and they will have already pled guilty to their underlying charges. They would be sent back to the originating judge, and then they could just go serve their sentence.
Once they get before the judge of the mental health court, what happens to them then?
Once someone is referred to the mental health court, then what happens is that they are seen by NKU grad students who assess what types of services they need. And then if they already have existing service providers, a lot of times these folks have already been seen or are currently patients of North Key. North Key Community Care provides mental health treatment, counseling, psychiatric care, that kind of thing. And so they might just go to their existing treatment facility or treatment provider. If they don't have treatment or they've been dissatisfied with their current treatment, then we have social workers who will align them with the services that they need. And then The other thing that happens is even if they have existing services, we'll look for maybe what triggered their existing services not working. You know, why did they all of a sudden slip and end up in jail? So we might add an extra service that they weren't currently using. Case management is a service that we think most of our participants will need, and that's primarily where we have a social worker type person call them a lot, follow up with them a lot, make sure that they're staying on track and making their appointments.
You mentioned that NKU graduate students are part of the program. In what other ways is NKU involved?
NKU is a very big partner in this mental health court. First of all, I, of course, have written some of the grants in conjunction with Dr. Amy Thistlewaite, who's in political science and criminal justice. And I also, both Dr. Thistlethwaite and myself work with Dr. Greg Hatchett, who's in counseling and social work. We also work with Dave Wilkerson, who's a licensed social worker. He is affiliated with NKU. He oversees the grad students. We have several graduate students who work for us in administrating the court and in also providing services and assessment. We'll have another PhD student in the spring, but we've had a half a dozen or more students working ongoing in this project during planning and through implementation, and we anticipate more students getting involved as the court progresses. Oh, and there's one other thing. In the very beginning, NKU also granted us a community partnership grant, $55,000 for a two-year period. That money has gone towards planning the court and also evaluating the court in its first year of implementation.
What happens to people who go through the court, get their treatment, and then commit another crime?
If someone commits a crime and they've been in the program for a while and they've been stabilized and then they commit another crime, we have the power to send them back to the originating court. The originating court can then make them serve the original sentence that they pled guilty to. That's one option. Another option would be the judge who presides, Judge Charlie Moore from Boone County. Judge Moore has the option of issuing sanctions, meaning he could put someone in jail for a short period of time to, instead of sending them back, he could try and maybe give them a little wake-up call and say, here, you're going to serve a week in jail and let's see if that gets you back into compliance mode.
Are you vowing to lose weight, quit smoking, get out of debt, or improve your life in some other way in 2009? Well, you're not alone. Millions of people will make resolutions for the new year, but not many of them will hold for long. I talked about resolutions with Stacy Vicari, a Louisville-based life coach who helps people assess and make changes in their lives. How many people do you estimate make New Year's resolutions?
This year, 60% of Americans, and this was, of course, 2008, 60% of Americans made New Year's resolutions. Studies show that only 15% of those making resolutions really follow through on those goals 6 months later.
I thought it would be a little higher than that. Well, do people, what happens to make that number so low?
You know, I think for most people, it's that they are unrealistic when they establish their New Year's resolutions, and it's not substantiated with a plan. The desire is there, but the planning process to actually follow through over the extended period of time it will take to actually achieve their goal is not there for people.
People set the bar too high?
I don't even think that they set it too high necessarily. Like a person could say, I want to lose 15 pounds. Well, they may very much be able to have 15 pounds to lose, right? Like they could have 15 pounds that could easily come off. That isn't unrealistic. It's just that they don't do the part that's the most important piece, which is to say, well, if I take myself out to how long it's going to take me to lose 15 pounds and work backwards, what do I have to do between now and that time to make that goal attainable?
Do the work and stay with it, I guess, is the hard part, right?
That's exactly right. And so it's very easy to say, oh, I want to, you know, change my diet or I want to lose weight. But unless it's substantiated with a concrete plan that's quantifiable for people, most people will lose their motivation or their enthusiasm, and then everything falls to pieces.
I belong to a YMCA, and I don't go that often, but every January I see all these new faces, and then as time goes on, we get into February and March, and it kind of dwindles, and you see the same people.
It does. And, you know, I think there's another piece to this, too. It's not just the establishing of goals and the follow-through and the planning. I think a lot of it is mental, and I think it's about keeping your mind fresh and positive about your ability to follow through on what you say you're going to do. And I think that's a big component for people. A lot of people have a lot of negative self-talk that begins to become their reality before they're able to make enough movement in their goals to experience success.
What do you guess the most common New Year's resolution is? Lose weight?
It's definitely lose weight.
I know a lot of people, we don't have as many smokers as we used to, but a lot of people used to put that on the agenda too.
Exactly. And getting out of debt, getting organized, a lot of those are very common.
So where do you come in here? Do you help people kind of through the process and realizing these goals?
I do. You know, where I come in is that I'm actually not even an advocate of resolutions. I think that resolutions are sort of a recipe for, you know, unfulfillment. I'm more an advocate of helping people set goals that are integrated integrated in the rest of the vision of their life.
I see. Now, do you do one-on-one with folks, or is this something you do more in a group setting?
No, I do. You know, the vast majority of what I do is one-on-one, and then I do an all-day workshop twice a year, one of which is coming up February 7th. But the 98% of my work is one-on-one by people here in Louisville and all over the country because I do it by phone. And it's working with people in a very structured way to help them achieve what it is they want to work on.
And, you know, I guess with resolutions, people fail once and then they say, well, you know, that's it. But
yeah.
Just keep trying.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that once people have the memory and experience of failing, it takes a little bit more effort the next time to get them to get a little bit farther along. And so I think that's where working with a coach can really be helpful, because you actually have somebody that's always remaining as a stand for you. And what I mean by that is I'm unwavered, right? I don't have the same issues that people have and the same insecurities that they have about achieving their goals. So I'm just standing in front of them as sort of a pillar of strength and possibility of what they can accomplish if they stay focused.
Now, does your business really pick up this time of year?
It does. It does. I'm very busy. And I'm actually, you know, despite what a lot of people think, my second busiest month to January is actually December.
Really?
Yeah, I have a lot of people, a lot of clients and others that I do year-end review sessions. So I actually work with people at the end of the year to help them review their year and then set their intentions and goals for the upcoming year and then the plan for how we're going to work that plan.
Well, Stacy, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Stacy Vicari is a Louisville-based life coach and owner of Ideal Life, which helps people with personal growth and motivation. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Robin Fisher has one of our favorite interviews of 2008. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The end of the year is typically a time to reflect on the past 12 months, and that's what we've been doing at Studio 619. We now bring you one of our favorite interviews of 2008. Oftentimes, novels can tackle topics too controversial for everyday conversation. Fictional characters are given more leeway to express their opinions or observations. The main character of the new book, Land of 100 Wonders, is no exception. Robin Fisher spoke with author Leslie Kagan about developing a character with a traumatic brain injury and how this frees the character from social conventions.
So your main character, Gibby McGraw, in A Land of 100 Wonders, has suffered a traumatic brain injury from a car accident.
Yes.
Did you have some trepidation having someone with this type of injury be your main character? I mean, it sort of reminded me of Icy Sparks and Gwen Rubio's novel, who had Tourette's. And it's sort of a, is it a delicate balance as to how to play this character?
I found, well, a whole gamut of things here. As far as traumatic brain injuries go, they do run from sort of mild and recoverable to really severe and non-recoverable. And I had a little experience. I had a friend who was in a horrible car crash and received a traumatic brain injury. Thank goodness hers was the rather mild and recoverable, at least I think it is. She doesn't. No, she wouldn't like me saying that. But my friend Chris, and so I knew a little bit about the process and what it would take to write in from that voice. I also felt that it was a very, very delicate balance for me. I found Land of 100 Wonders difficult. Because Gibby is who she is, and because her traumatic brain injury, or her not-quite-rightness, as her grandpa calls it, it was complicated to make sure that I remembered that there were certain things that she was able to do and certain things that she could not do, that she could remember and that she couldn't remember. That was the biggest challenge, I think, in writing the book, and making sure that she came off authentic. And not at all sort of me thinking what a traumatic brain injury person would act like.
Right, not contrived.
Yeah, not contrived at all, but genuine. And I think all of us at certain parts of our life, or even certain times within the day, feel not quite right. And so I tried to focus very much on that feeling of having that feeling and what that meant to me and how it was difficult for me sometimes to figure the way things worked and how I would approach life and see it as such a big puzzle at times. So in many ways, it was easy for me to get into the voice of Gibby, but at the same time, I needed to keep that balance. It was really important to me.
Well, I found it to be really interesting because one of my favorite fictional devices is the unreliable narrator. But this is the first time that I have read a book where the narrator has been unreliable unintentionally.
Yes. She does try. She does not believe herself to be unreliable.
Right. And it is just as much a surprise to her when she remembers something as it is to the reader when they realize they don't have the full story.
Correct. Gibb operates from a place in within herself that is very positive, very can-do, admits that, yet yes, she has a hard time remembering words and their meanings, and her mind does wander more than God's chosen people. And she has some disinhibition, so she has a problem with cursing. And she knows those things. But she does not, in my sense, when writing her, does not actually see that as a deficit. She sees this as something that she has, just like she has a certain color hair and a certain color eyes. And it's something that she'd like certainly to work on. But I don't think at all that Gibby sees herself in any way as being disabled or unnormal.
Well, she's never self-pitying.
Never. That just would never, ever cross Gibby's mind.
Which I think is interesting. And I think that one reason that that is believable is because her grandfather won't allow it.
Absolutely 100%. As she, there's a line in the book that said, you know, as Grandpa would say, go ahead and cry, nobody's listening. He's a tough Texas cowboy. And he's not going to put up with that sort of thing. He adores Gibby. He would give his life for Gibby. But he also has standards and a value towards life that's very particular in his own sense, in his own way. Grandpa has a sort of code of honor, and which he then, sort of puts on to Gibby as well. And I think she's happy to sort of take that on, too. It gives her a sense of structure.
You tackle some pretty heavy themes in the book, but before we get to talking about those, I want to talk about the juxtaposition to the heavy themes and the humor, because the humor is sort of unexpected. It sneaks up on you. The first time that I laughed out loud was when she was working with her grandfather on one of her stories, and she made the comment that ever since she had put a photograph, an inappropriate photograph, in her newspaper, that her grandfather felt that he needed to review all of her stories.
Yes.
And it was a laugh out loud moment in the book.
I'm glad. I think Gibby has, although Gibby herself will tell you that she has no sense of humor anymore, that it's very difficult for her to understand jokes. She is hilariously funny, I hope, but in such a natural, unassuming, unforced kind of way. We find her funny. She herself does not see the humor in what she's doing. I think it's really important. I like to write about, I don't know if I'd call them heavier themes, but a little bit deeper stuff that that I feel strongly about. And I find when I'm reading books that have a stronger and deeper theme, I don't like to be hit over the head. I like to have a little light touch. I think that it works better for me to see the difficulties in life through a sense of humor. I think it's the only way that many of us can transcend any kind of pain is to be able to step back and to see the humor in it. And everything that I write, Whistling in the Dark, my first book, I think the same sort of thing. I think it's partially my style and partially it is who I am as a human being coming in through the characters.
Well, you know, that sort of leads me to something else that I wanted to ask. You tackle the themes of race relations, Vietnam War, unwed motherhood, and let's just say the book is set in 1973, so these concerns are very immediate.
Yes.
Gibb is able to say things about these issues because she is not quite right.
Correct.
That people listen to, but they would never say themselves.
I think that partially... one of the most wonderful things about Gibby is that she's lost that filter that keeps us from saying things. In other words, Gibb says the truth as she sees it. She does not have to worry about political correctness or saying something that might offend somebody. Because I think also within Gibby, you sense such a deep, deep heart that and kindness and love, that the things that Gibb says are never mean-spirited, but they are honest as she sees them.
Now, you have another character in the book, Billy, who also has had, I guess what you would call a brain injury. It's more of an emotional injury from being in the war. He seems to be a much more wounded character than Gibby.
Well, he's, I think if you look at all the characters within the book, there's not one person who you would call quite right. And I think that's part of the issue that I wanted to address. This whole sense of normal that I think so many of us try to live up to when we're all kind of struggling. It's hard. Life is hard. It's hard for all of us. And to constantly have this normal, this need to be normal or this need to fit into a specific place within life, it's hard enough to just kind of cope with everything that goes on within our daily life without having to meet that standard as well. And I this is my personal campaign, Robin. I just like everybody kind of just say, okay, you can just be whoever you want to be. I really like that idea. Maybe it's naive, but I've started to wear my pajamas to the grocery store in protest. I've decided, heck, I'm going to do kind of what I want to do as long as it's not hurting anybody. As far as Billy goes, Billy's suffering from what we know now as post-traumatic stress disorder after war. Many soldiers right now in Iraq are coming home with post-traumatic stress, and same as in Vietnam, but they didn't really have the label for it back then. Billy has a very hard time coping with what he's done in the Vietnam War and readjusting back to life in small town Cray Ridge.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Leslie Kagan about her new book, Land of 100 Wonders. There's more information at our website, WFPL.org.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.